and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to our special series on my PhD thesis. So last time we concluded our second chapter, which examined the idea of insult, we saw that exceptions to the script of seeking satisfaction did exist, and that insult was essentially in the eye of the beholder. Palmerston could choose to take offence at Grace's mistreatment of David Pacifico, yet declare that Britain was not offended when Spain rudely expelled her ambassador. It's almost as though political as well as ideological motives suffused national honour, and these were expressed through the rhetoric used by contemporary statesmen and the press. Here we begin a new chapter with a focus on Anglo-American relations. If the timeline of 1838 to 1846 is giving you déjà vu, then you should be reminded, all patrons, of access to our 12-part series called Diplomacy, Britain vs. America, which goes into more background detail for this period. Now, I wouldn't go as far as saying you need to listen to that series before listening to this chapter, but some of the nuances of Anglo-American diplomacy and some of the gaps in context, which space and time force me to gloss over in the thesis, have been covered in more detail elsewhere. And if this series is feeling a bit dense right now, you could do worse than revisit that series, which was released in early 2023. That being said, this chapter takes a different focus to the others, as it is tasked exclusively with Anglo-American diplomacy, and Europe is largely sidelined. It is noteworthy that these confrontations were taking place parallel and often simultaneously to events in Europe and elsewhere. The Opium War, Eastern Question, and a general deterioration in Anglo-French relations were all ongoing as successive British governments tried to fix the American problem. And what a problem it was. Years of disagreements and temporary fixes had been passed down to the Whig government in the late 1830s, but only after Peel's Conservatives took office in 1841 was much progress made. Palmerston arguably suffered from having too much on his plate at once, but when the Whigs left government in autumn 1841, they were replaced by an administration which was better positioned to do business with Washington. This business revolved around the question of compromise. Could a degree of give and take be acceptable to the publics of both powers, or were intractable problems always destined to pull the two English-speaking powers apart? Washington and London both grappled with insults, but the promise of trade opportunities was definitely an incentive. Border disputes fanned additional flames, but when Peel's government took the reins, there was little appetite for war with the United States. In a time where the Conservatives were attempting to redefine their position on the domestic economy, palpable in Peel's gradual conversion to abolishing the protectionist Corn Laws, a friendly America with beneficial trade deals could improve British prospects during the general economic and agricultural slump of the 1840s. But to make these compromises, to resolve these differences, Peel and Lord Melbourne before him would have to defend these choices, always being wary of the rhetoric of national honour and its potential to ruin the picture they were painting. It was necessary to co-opt the support of newspapers to make this case, as we'll see in later sections of this chapter. And this was where Palmerston's replacement as Foreign Secretary, the Earl of Aberdeen, truly shines through. This research highlights the fact that while the rhetoric of national honour could aid the government in framing and justifying its policy, it could also constrain them. In fact, I would argue this constraining aspect of national honour's rhetoric is a major theme of this chapter, which further deepens our understanding of how national honour worked, or was said to work. With the opposition, now featuring Palmerston, always waiting in the wings to lament the damage done to national honour, whether sincerely or otherwise, Aberdeen would be forced to take Palmerston's own tactics to the next level. Because although Palmerston had used his contacts with newspapers to his advantage, Aberdeen felt compelled to lean on The Times, Britain's most prolific newspaper, to change the narrative around Anglo-American relations, particularly over the fate of Oregon. Before all this happened though, and before Aberdeen was even Foreign Secretary, Melbourne and Palmerston had to contend with troubling news coming out of the United States in the late 1830s. Following a dangerous Canadian rebellion which resulted in the death of a US citizen and the destruction of private property, everyone's favourite randomer, Alexander MacLeod, was selected as the culprit. New York claimed to have found their man and their scapegoat for all the insults that Britain had inflicted upon the Americans, but even Washington was unsure of these conclusions. Palmerston, of course, was more than willing to use this insult to a British citizen as a chance to cry foul, but first he would have to actually spend some time away from his European schemes, and this proved easier said than done. There's a lot to come in this chapter, so I hope you'll join me as we dig into it. I will now take you all to the first part of Chapter 3. Chapter 3, Insult and Compromise in Anglo-American Relations, 1838-1846. Introduction. As Rebecca Matsky has noted, the period between 1838 and 1846 was one of constant crisis in Anglo-American relations, exacerbated by the burning of the Caroline, 1837, the detention of Alexander MacLeod, 1840-41, the Creole Controversy of 1841, the resolution of the northeast boundary between Canada and the United States, 1842, and the Oregon Treaty of 1846. Throughout this period of crisis, negotiation was the sole means of resolving disputes, though such negotiations would have to be conducted carefully, particularly when national honour was at stake. In fact, the rhetoric surrounding national honour made Anglo-American compromise more difficult and compelled British governments to increase their military capacity. The extent to which the ethic constrained each power's freedom of action was recognised by The Globe, which carried the Boston Daily Advertiser's comments in April 1840. National honour imposes an insuperable objection to an adjustment. It compels each party to be its own umpire and to insist on the other party being governed by its decision. One party must yield, and by the same rule, this can only be done after the chances of war have been appealed to. If we cannot concede any part of our claim to the spirit of compromise and the love of peace, neither can Great Britain. The two parties, in this view of the matter, stand precisely in the same light. Great Britain can no more recede without dishonour, if there be anything in this idea, than we can. These sentiments encapsulate the recurring theme of this chapter. National honour placed immense pressure upon contemporaries, who understood that whenever they failed to adhere to its requirements, they could expect its accompanying rhetoric to be used against them. As demonstrated in previous chapters, national honour was a contested political space. Lord Melbourne's Whig government had enjoyed popular approval, thanks in large part to Palmerston's fulfilment of its tenets. However, the Foreign Secretary faced immense challenges in applying these tenets when confronted by American intransigence, notwithstanding the treatment of Alexander MacLeod, which constituted an insult. Similarly, when Sir Robert Peel's Conservatives assumed power in 1841, the Earl of Aberdeen struggled to defend the Webster-Ashburton Treaty against critics such as Palmerston, who insisted that he had made excessive concessions to American bluster. Interestingly, when attempting to resolve the dispute over Oregon, Aberdeen proved more adept and utilized his press and personnel contacts to bypass the rhetoric of national honor and to present the eventual settlement as an honorable, favorable compromise. This suggests further nuances inherent in the honor script. Statesmen could fail to succeed in their efforts to press its principles without much consequence, while they could also push national honour aside when the ethic proved inconvenient to political or strategic gain. Further, this chapter reveals further depths to the lexicon of honour, particularly in the realm of negotiation and compromise. What is clear is that contemporaries on both sides of the aisle could not ignore national honour. This section will address the rhetoric of national honour in this crisis period of Anglo-American relations. It will also explore the relevant themes which the mutual antagonism of the two parties brought forward. It will be argued that national honour was used to unify British political sentiment and to attack political rivals, while the exclusion of the ethic complemented the resolution of disputes by making compromise more acceptable. It is worth highlighting that many of the studies used for this chapter are several decades old. While they provide valuable context and debates, including the use of the press to bypass outcry, these scholars never interrogated national honour or its rhetoric, despite referencing such concepts throughout their narratives. National honour exists in the background of their analyses, yet it will be argued here that the ethic provides a deeper explanation for the difficulties faced by Anglo-American negotiators. It constrained statesmen and subjected them to uncomfortable rhetoric both in Parliament and in the press. It should be noted that the Times is prioritised above other newspapers, as it had an influence over public opinion in England, described as proverbial, while benefiting from its political independence, high-quality editorials, and unrivalled reporting. It is therefore important to observe the Times' shift towards the Conservatives and the pivotal role it played in aiding Aberdeen's resolution of the Oregon question. The rhetoric of national honour was prevalent in these trends and recommends greater analysis to comprehend this crisis period of Anglo-American relations. Part 1. Insult and Concession in the MacLeod and Main Boundary Disputes. The eruption of revolt in Upper and Lower Canada in late 1837 represented the beginning of a crisis period in Anglo-American relations. While officially neutral, some American citizens enlisted with the Canadian rebels, increasing cross-border tensions. Although Britain suppressed the revolt by December 1837, one confrontation in the American portion of the Niagara River caused the destruction of a privately owned American vessel, the Caroline, and the death of Amos Durfee, an American citizen. American President Martin Van Buren protested, but Palmerston effectively ignored this protest. As shown in Chapter 1, he concentrated on the deterioration of the Ottoman Empire and the resolution of the Eastern question. This resolved in Palmerston's favour, he expected the resounding approval of his peers when Parliament reconvened in spring 1841. But instead, Palmerston was confronted by the imprisonment of Alexander MacLeod in New York. Arrested in November 1840, MacLeod was held responsible for Durfee's murder and the burning of the Caroline, and the controversy continued into the following year. MacLeod's detention was presented to Parliament on the 8th of February 1841. His treatment was decried as an insult, and his fate was closely associated with the national honour. The constitutional complexities of the United States and New York's freedom of action to deal with MacLeod caused additional irritation and confusion. Shortly thereafter, Palmerston underlined his determination to demand MacLeod's release upon threat of war with the United States, a course which amounted to an ultimatum. There was nothing unfamiliar in Palmerston's position. Whether it was Captain Elliot in Canton or David Pacifico in Athens, contemporaries had used the rhetoric of national honour to impress the close connection of the ethic to the treatment of British subjects overseas. According to Avner Offer's honour script, the insult which had been incurred had to be repelled, lest the nation be said to suffer dishonour and a loss in security. In pragmatic political terms, this outcome was intolerable for Palmerston's presentation of himself and his foreign policy. He had no choice but to apply the same principles which had recently been applied to France and China. The Foreign Secretary's response would have to be sufficiently satisfactory to maintain his political consistency and meet the demands of national honour. If he failed, Palmerston could expect that the same rhetoric, which he had used in moments of crisis, would be deployed by his political and press adversaries against him. The raw shock at the insult initially benefited Palmerston, and his stance was applauded by occasionally surprising allies. Speaking to the Commons on the MacLeod issue in early March 1841, the Irish MP and later participant in the Young Ireland Rebellion, William Smith O'Brien, asserted that while Britain did not seek war, she could not, however, maintain her rank as the greatest nation of the world if she allowed herself to be insulted, and she could not be entitled to claim the allegiance of her colonial subjects if she did not extend to them adequate protection. Recalling Palmerston's success in defying France and preserving Ottoman integrity, O'Brien urged Palmerston to display some portion of the vigour he had shown in connection with affairs of the East. This would involve the dispatch of a strong fleet off the North American harbours and a powerful army along the line of the British-American boundary, then by mere unsupported diplomacy. Should the country require greater increases in defence spending, O'Brien felt assured that the House would support them in measures necessary for the maintenance of the honour and character of Great Britain in every part of the world. The solution, O'Brien declared, was to show Washington that Britain was in earnest via a demonstration of British power. During a debate on increased military estimates later in the month, Sir Robert Peel expressed approval of the increases. He qualified this by declaring his preference for peace, before reassuring members that if the interests, the honour, the essential welfare of the country involved in war, he could forget that council, and standing by the ancient fame and reputation of this great people, he would lend his voice for war in order to prove to the world that our military fame stood now as high as ever. Notably, in reference to the United States, Peel voiced his support for Palmerston's stance, arguing, "It would not be for the true policy of this country to purchase any settlement of the present difficulty by any unjust concessions." In his letter to the Queen, John Russell commended this remarkable speech, interpreting Peel to have said that, much as he disliked war, if the honour or interests of the country required it, he should sink all internal differences and support the government. Russell recalled the loud cheers which accompanied these declarations and believed the speech very creditable to the Conservative leader. The Times echoed these sentiments, explaining that Britain could afford to dispense with a false sense of honour because our appetite for military glory, if ever it had a place in British policy, has been satiated to the full. Yet the Times asserted that the paramount necessity of preserving our dependencies from lawless aggression and of protecting the life of a British subject who has done his country good service in that particular could never be permitted, consistently with our national honour, to give place to any other considerations whatever, even if war with all its calamities should be the inevitable consequences. The release of MacLeod would be as indispensable to British honour as it would be creditable to American justice, and the Americans were further cautioned that while Britain had won her glory and peacefully sheathed her sword in recent years, she will brook much, everything except a compromise of her honour rather than draw it again. MacLeod pleaded not guilty that month, and New York's governor, William Seward, attempted to assuage British fears by committing to MacLeod's fair treatment, while also insisting on the maintenance of state rights. It did not seem to matter that the case against MacLeod was not particularly strong. The evidence consisted of MacLeod's drunken boasts and dubious statements from New York officials who appeared determined to acquire their own satisfaction for the Caroline's destruction. There was some criticism of this tenuous evidence, but MacLeod's predicament may be viewed as a consequence of Palmerston's failure to resolve the Caroline controversy. The historian Kenneth Stevens noted that disagreement on the issues probably could have been narrowed if the British government had responded, in 1838, with a prompt expression of regret about the Caroline in language which did not have to constitute an apology. Yet this is to misunderstand Palmerston's true intentions, as it understates his political acumen. As Wilbur Jones discerned, Palmerston was willing to force the matter with America because he understood that while members in the Commons were lethargic and even bored when a foreign affairs issue involved some narrow political or economic interest, an issue bearing on national honour would rally not only the Whig-Liberal coalition, but would bring the Conservatives to their feet en masse. As this research project has shown, the Foreign Secretary was adept in sensing such opportunities, not just in domestic politics, but also abroad. British naval force had been deployed to great effect in China and Syria, which demonstrated to Washington that Britain could project its military power wherever it was needed, while providing Palmerston with additional political capital. Important changes in American personnel also influenced the crisis. By April 1841, John Tyler had assumed the presidency, while Daniel Webster became his Secretary of State. Webster was known in England and had visited the country in 1839. Of additional importance was the appointment of known Anglophile and abolitionist Andrew Everett as American ambassador to London during the summer. As these appointments were learned of, London improved its North American military position. Canada received over 10,000 soldiers since the revolt, alongside four steamers and patrol boats on the Great Lakes. British understanding of American vulnerabilities could also be leveraged. The discrepancy in naval power between the two powers, the inadequacy of American coastal defences, and the capabilities of steam technology informed Palmerston's defiance. The American ambassador to France reported that Britain's Mediterranean fleet had moved to Gibraltar and expected that these vessels were preparing to rush to Halifax, where they would prepare for war or, at the very least, back up Palmerston's diplomacy with a firm naval hand. Yet this intensity of feeling on both sides of the Atlantic gave way, by April, to a kind of détente, and the subject largely disappeared from Parliament. Palmerston was then informed of Captain Elliot's preliminary peace treaty with China, which left him mortified and disappointed. Writing to the King of Belgium, the Queen appreciated that Elliot completely disobeyed his orders and tried to get the lowest terms he could, for which he was replaced. This unimpressive result recommended a focus on Macleod to distract the public and rally the government, but following the initial outcry, Palmerston did not use the insult as energetically as he had in previous cases. In fact, Macleod's predicament had become increasingly complex. One issue was the government's opacity regarding responsibility for the Caroline and a refusal to present public correspondence which had been made available to members of Congress. Domestic politics had also become unfavourable. Facing defeat over the sugar duties bill and budget, Melbourne's Whig government appeared close to resignation. In May, Palmerston pressed Melbourne for the dissolution of Parliament, to which the Queen assented in June, and anticipation over the looming general election occupied much of the summer. This context is important as it weakened Palmerston's position, thereby reducing his ability to leverage the insult for political gain. Amid these parliamentary and political distractions, the British press kept Macleod's predicament alive. The Times was key to this campaign. It identified the American Constitution as a key obstacle to satisfaction, as it enabled Washington to declare with great solemnity that the entire affair belonged to a particular province of the Federal Republic, with whose internal rights no interference could be constitutionally exercised. The Times lamented that month after month was spent in this sort of fencing, while a spirit of animosity between the two countries was rapidly and perilously engendered. It observed with palpable frustration that the original pretext that the central government could not interfere with the legal jurisdiction of an independent state belonging to the Union was rendered hollow by the Attorney General's presence at Macleod's trial. The Times thus believed that the discreditable shuffle over Macleod would follow the course prescribed by American law, and Britain would be forced to wait until Macleod's trial in October. Because of these delays, the cauldron has boiled over and exhausted itself in idle and contemptible vapour. To some, Washington was not the only party responsible for this curious climb down. The Hull Packet newspaper complained that this is a case upon which no compromise ought to have been permitted. London should have insisted upon the instant discharge of Mr. Macleod, and if denied, New York should have been blockaded and, if necessary, bombarded. It was understood that the Americans, like the Chinese, can only be dealt with through the medium of their fears, nor will they ascribe the forbearance of England to any other cause than an inability to vindicate her rights and to protect her people. With a hint of nostalgia, the Hull Packet concluded that in the past, Mr. Macleod would not have been suffered to remain in prison an hour longer than an armament could have been sent from this country to release him. Yet now, we are fallen on evil times, which the Hull Packet blamed on the incubus of liberalism, which, seems to be freezing all our energies, except when we can bully minor states, and is gradually sinking us lower and lower in our own estimation, as well as that of our neighbours. Similarly, by early May 1841, the Times was blaming Melbourne's government for the crisis, arguing that if Ambassador Fox in Washington had been backed with suitable energy at home, MacLeod would have been at large a considerable while ago, and the honour of Great Britain would have been proportionally unsullied. In a Commons session of the 7th of May, Joseph Hume called for the publication of correspondence related to the incident. John Russell's response was unhelpful, as the Secretary for the Colonies claimed, "The production of the correspondence in question would not enable the honourable gentleman to attain the object he had in view." Sir Robert Peel did not support this request. Conversely, Thomas Duncombe reminded members that, "Whether that information was withheld or not, it was MacLeod's fate that truly mattered, since the feeling throughout the country was this, that our national honour was compromised by the detention in prison of Mr. MacLeod." Duncombe thus asked whether the government meant to allow Mr. MacLeod's trial to proceed, as he had already been imprisoned for 6 months and the people of England had a right to know why. This was a prescient challenge. Did Palmerston not wish to acquire redress for insult? If New York was permitted to continue their proceedings, would this not suggest MacLeod had been abandoned? The Times maintained its criticism of Washington's endless shufflings and shirkings over its right to interfere in New York's actions, which were all tending to affront our national honour and to inflict the grossest injustice upon a British subject. In fact, the question of who should have jurisdiction to try MacLeod did affect Washington's ability to resolve the crisis, and the matter was delayed into the summer. The complicated legal manoeuvres between New York's Senate, the Presidency, Governor Seward, Congress, and the Supreme Court prevented the construction of a coherent American policy towards MacLeod. Domestic American disputes, twinned with delays caused by cross-Atlantic communications and the unavailability of essential documents, created a predictable void in information as Parliament was dissolved in late June. Further, just as Britons perceived their honour at stake in MacLeod's fate, Daniel Webster identified American honour with the Caroline. Washington's efforts to leverage one issue against the other were unsuccessful, but while the Caroline issue remained outstanding, London was unlikely to enjoy much American goodwill. Palmerston had waited several years before informing Washington that the Caroline had been destroyed on official orders rather than on the initiative of Canadian rebels, yet even then he refused to clarify whether the Americans were due reparation. As MacLeod would not be released until the Caroline issue was resolved, these delays could give the impression that the Foreign Secretary was merely waiting on events. In late June 1841, the Times criticised the abject manner in which Lord Melbourne's government has digested, in the case of MacLeod, the most flagrant insult ever offered to a great nation, which has brought the British name into general contempt and destroyed that salutary fear of our power in the United States, which was the surest guarantee for the continuance of peace. A reduction in this fear meant a reduction in prestige, and Palmerston's vaunted foreign policy had entangled us in wars and intrigues throughout the world, and stained the national honour. Commenting on the damage done by a month of silence on the matter, the Times reflected in early August that French newspapers contend that the honour of Great Britain is compromised, as the British government would not move in the affair until the result should become known. The following day, the Times returned to MacLeod's fate by commenting on the diplomatic reserve and legal quibbling which obscured the questions Britons might have had. Yet, the people of England had not lost sight of the main fact that one of the Queen's subjects is rotting in a foreign jail under a charge of having done an act which the British government acknowledges and applauds, but which Washington intended to punish. Remarking on the pitiful state of the controversy, the Times concluded that if anything could add to the humiliation of allowing a British subject to be tried as a felon for a gallant action performed against a band of outlaws and pirates, it was that a demand for his release made by a British minister should be followed by no result, and that the strong and united opinion of the country should be ineffectual even to accelerate the tardy formalities of the law. Evidently, no amount of public uproar could dissuade the Americans from proceeding as they had intended. Because of this, the Exeter and Plymouth Gazette feared that the detention of Mr. MacLeod as a prisoner in the United States will ultimately lead to hostilities, while noting that it remains to be seen whether our ambassador will not be immediately recalled or whether this country will submit to such outrage and insult. Other organs assigned blame to MacLeod himself, whose decision to submit to American jurisdiction meant that he was either ignorant of his real position as the servant and accredited agent of a nation, or careless of the honour and respectability of the British government. When Parliament reconvened in late August 1841, John Roebuck discerned that if the Caroline's destruction was viewed by Washington as a national outrage, then MacLeod's detention arising from that destruction should not remain a local affair. Palmerston agreed and emphasized the need for redress notwithstanding the complexities of the Republic, since if a wrong were done, redress must be given, and if the laws and constitution of the country did not enable the government to give that redress, then Washington must either alter the laws and change their constitution or submit to the alternative which every country in such a case was like a private individual entitled to adopt. Washington could not obscure its responsibility to British demands by hiding behind its constitution, which, as Palmerston pointed out, did not allow for New York's independent line from the federal government in any case. Yet, compared to the traditional standards of activity directed against such insults, it was difficult to deny that Parliament was distracted by the looming change in government. During a debate in late August, which finally moved Melbourne's government to resign, one member asserted that whatever was done to MacLeod was done to the British nation. Another reiterated the principle that the very trial of MacLeod compromised our national honour, since although we might save the shedding of his blood, we could not redeem our character in regard to the original question, that question being the inherent injustice of New York's decision to hold MacLeod responsible for British policy. Significantly, the Times blamed Palmerston and his colleagues for their dilatory and apathetic forbearance, and for instructing Ambassador Fox in Washington to endure so long the interminable American shufflings which still postpone and peril the honourable adjustment of this dispute. The Times challenged why MacLeod was still to be brought to trial, and why New York was permitted to frustrate British rights and patience. Although the mere disrepute which this affair brings upon Whig statesmanship is comparatively of little consequence, of far more importance was the very serious extent to which it compromises the honour of the British nation. The Times opined that every hour of MacLeod's detention is a deliberate insult to the British realm, and it complained that the Americans have given us everything our own way, but they will not give us Mr. MacLeod. Now this, we say, is an unbearable impertinence, derogatory in the highest degree to our national honour and character. If Washington would not guarantee against New York's usurpation of British rights in the future, then the insulted honour of Great Britain must forthwith redress itself by adopting the last resource, since Americans are alone responsible for the prompt and vigorous demonstrations which the vindication of British honour would seem to render inevitable. The Colonial Society concluded similarly that if MacLeod was executed, the Queen would direct the energies and resources of the empire over which Her Majesty rules in vindication of a national wrong, which, if suffered with impunity, would leave our numerous and widely dispersed colonists at the mercy of every lawless and unprincipled aggressor, and thus endanger the safety, peace, welfare, and honour of Her Majesty's possessions. In the mind of such editorials, an insult to a British subject was an insult to the British nation, and the inability to defend its citizens amounted to an admission of weakness which rivals would take advantage of. By mid-October, the Times' rhetoric intensified in the absence of any news, commenting that, "Whatever the fate of MacLeod, the day of reckoning with Great Britain remains, because Her Majesty's crown and dignity have sustained an aggravated assault in the person of MacLeod. Reparation, in some form or another, cannot be dispensed with. Because Her Majesty's crown and dignity have sustained an aggravated assault in the person of MacLeod. Reparation, in some form or another, cannot be dispensed with." The Times was clear that war we do not desire, nay, short of sacrifice of national honour, we would adopt almost any alternative to avoid it. The Times did not adjust its language for the benefit of a new Conservative government, though it continued to hold Palmerston responsible for the errors made in seeking reparation. Now in opposition, Palmerston had moved on from demanding satisfaction from Washington and prepared to recast himself as a leading critic of any overly generous settlement with the United States, despite having done materially little to settle these controversies himself. There were ample opportunities for tension regarding the inflammatory practice known as the right of search, which must be viewed in the context of slavery's role in British foreign policy. Indeed, during his final weeks in office, Palmerston arguably inflamed tensions further by asserting British privileges in the right of search, ensuring that Sir Robert Peel's administration would have to expend political capital to resolve such a contentious issue. It has been argued that this stance was not mere opportunism and can be reconciled with Palmerston's consistent opposition to slavery itself. The controversy over MacLeod's fate remained acute into the autumn, but impatience gave way to relief when his acquittal was confirmed during a week-long trial in mid-October, with news of his release reaching Britain in early November. Although London had warned that his execution would result in war, MacLeod was not acquitted because of Palmerston's threats, but from a lack of evidence. President Tyler upheld that MacLeod had been acquitted by the verdict of an impartial and intelligent jury, affirming his relief at the somewhat stilted anticlimax. Indeed, it may be argued that the MacLeod episode, while containing many of the features in common with similar insults, lacked much of the fervour, at least among ministers, which accompanied them. Facing defiance in such a distant theatre, Palmerston had little choice but to await the trial's outcome. The increasing likelihood of a Whig resignation certainly affected his ability to leverage the insult against his opponents for political gain. Parliament's inconsistent schedule, not to mention its distraction with pressing commercial matters, also meant that, whatever the true extent of public outcry, the insult was not pressed as far as Palmerston later authorised during the Trent affair, when he was in a much stabler political position. MacLeod's return to Canada suggested that Anglo-American relations could improve, particularly as a new Tory administration would now direct negotiations. However, the year-long confrontation over MacLeod merely lifted the lid from a box filled with problems and points of conflict between the two powers, and Conservative Foreign Secretary the Earl of Aberdeen believed that a dedicated mission to Washington would negotiate a resolution of these controversies. Yet, he would have to be careful of not going too far in meeting American demands. Any suggestion that Aberdeen had agreed to excessive concessions could be linked to national dishonour and would be politically disastrous for the Tories. Wilbur Jones observed that cabinet support for Aberdeen's American policy was only possible if his compromises did not involve British honour, because if a question of honour was raised, the Duke of Wellington would lead the walkout and the Prime Minister would fall in behind him. In December 1841, Lord Ashburton, a scion of the House of Baring, who enjoyed extensive American connections, was appointed to the head of this special mission. The Maine Canada boundary and the right of search, of prime importance to tackle the continuing slave trade, were key priorities. Both issues were likely to rouse American emotion, but there was at least an appreciation of the fact that the status quo of Maine's unsettled border was unsustainable. both parties had attempted to support their claims through the acquisition of archival material, though the accuracy of such documents was heavily contested. Aberdeen hoped Ashburton could overcome such difficulties, as his appointment would bypass Ambassador Fox in Washington, whom Aberdeen believed ineffectual. Thomas DeLuc underlined the importance of Canadian defence in the government's considerations, highlighting prestige as a mostly Palmerstonian concern. Kenneth Byrne added that Peel and Aberdeen prioritised the increase of Anglo-American trade above squabbles over frontier or even national honour, and believed Ashburton's American connections recommended him for the appointment. But the United States had their own list of subjects they were eager to resolve, and clarification over the slave trade was among the most prominent. The right of search linked American national honour to slavery, insofar as it highlighted the indignity of British interference with American ships. In his article examining Webster's use of propaganda within the treaty, Richard Courant wrote that American war hawks were shrilly clamouring for redress of all their real and fancied wrongs. These demands included an uncompromising settlement of the northeastern boundary controversy, outright title to all the Oregon country, apology and indemnity for the destruction of the ship Caroline in the Niagara River, and a clear renunciation of the alleged rights of search and impressment on the high seas. British newspapers were aware that MacLeod's acquittal did not represent the end of the controversy. In early November 1841, the Globe observed that it is not consistent with national honour that the claims of either nation upon the other should continue unsettled, while acknowledging that at any moment these disputed questions may be revived and may be converted into a casus belli between the two governments. The Colonial Gazette observed that of the occasions of difference between the United States and Great Britain, two are proper subjects of negotiation. The first was the boundary question, involving both the national point of honour and certain private interests, adding that it seems impossible to dispose of the point of honour except by the arbitration of a third power. The second point was the more general issue of America's frontier with Canada, which remained porous and subject to complication so long as the defect existed in America's constitution, which enabled her component states to take an individual line. Palmerston's failure to leverage the MacLeod insult to his advantage did not deter him from seeking an opportunity to upset the new government. It was certainly easier to launch these attacks from opposition benches, but Palmerston saved the bulk of his rhetorical fury for the following year, when the details of the settlement were revealed. Yet, as David Brown noted, Palmerston's concern was not wholly for prestige, but in displaying firmness during the boundary question, as the former Foreign Secretary also wished to enforce Britain's right of search for American vessels involved in the slave trade. Palmerston wanted Ashburton to include provisions to this end in the eventual Ashburton-Webster Treaty, but correspondence published in the Times on the 1st of January 1842 between Aberdeen and America's former ambassador, Stevenson, confirmed that the United States viewed the right of search less as a moral issue or one of international law, and instead as a dispute involving high questions of national honour and interests, of public law and individual rights. Further controversies complicated the picture. In November 1841, the Creole sailed into Nassau under the command of a crew of rebellious slaves. As slavery was illegal under British law, the slaves acquired British protection from local Americans who attempted to force them to return, and under threat of fire, the Creole returned to New Orleans without its human cargo. Just as Britain saw the treatment of their citizens within the context of national honour, American senators interpreted American honour in the incident. The details reached Washington in spring 1842, just before Ashburton arrived. American outrage at the Creole hampered Ashburton's progress, and by June, the Creole threatened to sink the negotiations altogether. Ashburton persevered, depending on the good offices of Webster to formulate a compromise on a wide range of issues. The settlement was described by Wilbur Jones as a splendid example of burying an insoluble problem under a mass of acceptable verbiage. Anglo-American interpretations of the right of search were allowed to exist side by side in recognition of the volatile nature of the controversy. President Tyler proved amenable to compromise over the Caroline, accepting an apology for the delay in communications while not demanding an apology for the act itself. Webster reciprocated with an apology for the delay in releasing MacLeod. Regarding the main boundary, compromise was facilitated by the lack of any uniform military opinion in London, and Aberdeen granted Ashburton leeway to cede more territory around the St. John River, while preserving Quebec's defensive advantages. With the Caroline, Creole, right of search and main boundary resolved, the Webster-Ashburton Treaty was signed on the 9th of August and ratified by the Senate 3 weeks later. While not interpreting national honour in the issues then debated, Aberdeen appreciated that its rhetoric could be weaponised against him if Washington acquired excessive concessions. Similarly, Daniel Webster suffused the treaty in propaganda and leveraged vague language to proclaim victory and guard against the potential weaponization of its articles against him. In the long run, however, this search for a domestic political victory exacerbated Anglo-American suspicions, particularly over the right of search, and it damaged trust in future negotiations. This included the most notable exclusion from the treaty, a settlement of Oregon. It was maintained as a disputed territory jointly administered by London and Washington, despite rapidly filling with American settlers. But this omission did not reduce Aberdeen's optimism, as he reflected to Ashburton, "The good temper in which you left them all and the prospect of continued peace with, I trust, improved friendly relations, far outweigh in my mind the value of any additional extent of Pine Swamp." Aberdeen understood that any concessions to the Americans, however excessive they might appear on the surface, could be justified if the treaty ushered in a new era of peaceful cooperation. However, by omitting Oregon, Aberdeen placed his faith in an uncertain future. If the Americans attempted to clarify Oregon's status in a hostile manner, critics could argue that Aberdeen had encouraged them by his concessions in this treaty. Unfortunately for Aberdeen, this was precisely what happened, though he could not have anticipated the impact of James K. Polk's presidency. With the issues of MacLeod and the main boundary resolved, could Anglo-American relations be expected to improve? It seems naive to think so, considering the controversy which existed over Oregon and the more belligerent messaging from Polk's presidency. Lacking this hindsight, Peel and Aberdeen were forced to try and patch things up as much as possible, hoping that the mutual interests of London and Washington would draw them closer together. These mutual interests should not be discounted, but an atmosphere of defiance and national pride were also in the air. Although the compromises should be lauded, the reception which greeted the Webster-Ashburton Treaty showed that it was easier to acquire a treaty than it was to maintain its popularity. If Britons linked concessionary policies with the Tories, then it wouldn't be long before Palmerston returned to the Foreign Office and the Whigs resumed power. But despite these challenges and many more in domestic politics, Peel's government proceeded with a cautious policy of accommodation with Washington. This approach was sensible, but as we'll see in the next episode, it reckoned without the lightning rod which was James K. Polk. I hope you'll join me for that, but until then, my name is Zach, and you've been listening to the first section of our thesis's third chapter. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for supporting this show, and I'll be seeing you all soon.